For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, a plea that you subscribe to it and, if you don't already, also to our YouTube and Rumble channels, and news that after a mere 12 years, a verdict has come in the case of Mann versus Stein, in which a jury in Washington, D.C. found Mark Stein guilty of defaming Michael Mann and causing him $1 in real damages, but then also awarding $1 million in punitive damages just because. It's bad news for public policy, because its main impact will surely be to stifle robust debate on a critical issue. But it's also bad news for Mann, we suspect, because of something called the Streisand effect, in which a celebrity's efforts to silence critics only draws attention to the problem the critics were talking about, which in this case is Mann's aggressive tactics and nasty language, which were amply exposed in the trial testimony. Now, we also believe, and we certainly hope, that the verdict will be successfully appealed, because we think it's unfair to Mark. The million-to-one ratio of real to punitive damages is absurdly out of line, even with American jurisprudence. And we think the place to debate science is in the public arena, not the courtroom. It's revealing that Stein's co-defendant, Rand Simberg, was also hit with $1 in real damages, but just $1,000 in punitive. It suggests that what the jury was trying to do was to punish Mark Stein for being an outspoken conservative, as was Mann himself. As Barbara Kay noted, one of Mann's emails that was revealed during the trial said, quote, "Going to talk with some big-time libel lawyers to see if there is the potential to bring down this filthy organization, National Review, for good." And of Stein himself, Mann emailed a colleague, "One fringe benefit of the lawsuit will be to ruin this odious excuse for a human being," end quote. And indeed, Mann is now saying that he'll try to revive his lawsuit against National Review, the magazine, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who were originally included but, after massive legal fees, were removed from the case. In our view, Mann's main claim of actual damages was laughable. As Andrew Lawton wrote during the trial, quote, "If what Michael Mann has endured is defamation, I want some. Virtually every aspect of Mann's career is better now than it was before Stein's and Simberg's blog posts were published. His salary is higher. He hangs out with celebrities such as Bill Clinton and Leonardo DiCaprio, with whom Mann testified to having a bromance. He was then working at Penn State, but is now at the Ivy League University of Pennsylvania. He's making more in book royalties," end quote. And it's also weird, speaking of legal bills, that we now know that Mann had someone with deep pockets paying all of his, but we don't know who. Possibly some climate alarmist billionaire like Bill Gates or Tom Steyer. Supposedly, it's we deniers who have all the money and get it from shadowy plutocrats, but when Mann turns out to have unlimited quantities and we know not from where, well, then it's okay. As, apparently, is the kind of rude and manipulative behavior that he engaged in, including making scurrilous sexual allegations against Georgia Tech climatologist Judith Curry to his colleagues. As the court transcript delicately put it, quote, "Mann, yes, I readily acknowledge I got those facts wrong. Mann declined to apologize to Professor Curry or her husband, who were both in court," end quote. Say, isn't that patriarchy in action? When the verdict was announced, Mann said, quote, "This is a victory for science, and it's a victory for scientists," end quote. But it's not. Not even for those on Mann's side. Would you want to be a journal editor getting one of Mann's behind-the-scenes calls to spike a paper? What about a journalist who still thinks that Mann's hockey stick handling of data was appallingly bad, as did a number of experts who testified during the trial? Might he sue you? Mann was revealed during the trial to have made improper contact with journal editors to spike rival scientists' papers. He referred to critics as human filth and worse. One of his collaborators testified at trial that he had deleted emails subject to potential Freedom of Information Act requests after Mann asked him to. It's ugly. And it gets worse. Mann famously lost a lawsuit against Canadian retired professor Tim Ball and was ordered to pay costs. But he never did, forcing Ball's widow Marty to crowdfund to pay for his 2022 funeral. And apparently, Ball's estate can't collect unless Mann comes to Canada. But it's really not nice not to pay up, especially given her circumstances. As Roger Pilkey Jr., who testified about Mann's professional conduct and reputation in the trial, wrote shortly before the decision, quote, "Whatever the jury verdict, the new revelations these past weeks in the Mann versus Stein-Simberg trial are far, far worse than anything that appeared in the ClimateGate emails. These revelations offer an important test for the climate science community and the legacy media, end quote. Indeed they do, and one they'll probably flunk. But Stein may appeal, and if his health holds up, he may win. We certainly hope so, and so should all real scientists, whatever their position on climate change. And now, a word from our sponsor, and that's you, our viewers and our readers. Because we're crowdfunded, we're not subsidized by governments, we don't get grants from giant environmental foundations, and we're not getting those oil company checks our critics keep talking about. It's you who sustain our work. So please click here and make a monthly pledge, $5, $10, $20, so that we can keep producing these videos and pushing back against mistaken, even deranged climate orthodoxy. And now, back to me. Meanwhile, outside the courtroom, there's something of a political rout of climate alarmists underway, including, quote, victory for Europe's farmers as Brussels caves in on emissions targets and eating less meat, end quote, from the Telegraph. While Politico fretted that, quote, Europe's Greens are on the ropes. Farmers' ire and a right-wing surge is testing the EU's climate policies, and the Greens that back them are teetering, end quote. Bloomberg warned that, quote, Germany's budget chaos leaves green energy projects in limbo, end quote. The Wall Street Journal wrote, quote, Europe's green agenda collides with geopolitical economic reality, end quote. And even Reuters, under a nest of headings, quote, climate and energy, environment, climate change, end quote, conceded that, quote, green backlash looms over EU elections, end quote. Now, people frequently tell pollsters what they know they're supposed to think, so there may never have been mass support for radical climate policies. But a large number of people also genuinely supported those policies because they'd been promised they would make us all better off. There was never mass buy-in to mass impoverishment to prevent tiny changes in temperature. And, to the extent that those in charge of public policy really believed that they could improve the weather at minimal cost, they're in a hole they dug themselves. As they also are if they knew it was untrue, but figured that by the time the public noticed it, it would be too late. Now, we'd far rather have public policy settled by civilized discussion than disruptive protests. But civilized discussion surely shows that there was this amazing desire on the part of European governments to make a bad situation worse. Manufacturing was withering, citizens were suffering cold due to high energy prices driven by net zero obsessions, so they decided to demolish agriculture at the same time and then say, you didn't really want that food. There's a remarkable lack of realism here, and the rubber is hitting the road, including the rubber from tractor tires. The critical components of survival are food, clothing, and shelter, and they're taking aim at two of them. Or even three, if you understand how much modern fabric depends on petrochemicals for its manufacture and even feedstocks. And if you don't understand that, you should not be entrusted with public office or regarded as an expert. Speaking of experts, the University of Toronto figures the right way to deal with the collapse of university credibility and finances is to slash carbon emissions on its storied St. George campus in Toronto by 2027. It will spend $138 million or more, much of it from the Government Canadian Infrastructure Bank. But even so, they plan to keep four gas boilers and one gas turbine intact because fossil fuels actually work. And then we go, that old thing? Because both the Canadian Press and The Guardian, via MSN, tell us, quote, ocean system that moves heat gets closer to collapse, which could cause weather chaos, study says, end quote, and, quote, Atlantic Ocean circulation nearing devastating tipping point, study finds, end quote. And, if you're into nameless dread, The Guardian adds, quote, the scientists behind the research said they were shocked at the forecast speed of collapse once the point is reached, although they said it was not yet possible to predict how soon that would happen, end quote. So, if you're into settled science, predictions you can test, and studies based on the real world, not computer models, give it a miss. Ah, and something called News, again via MSN, asks, quote, how did the Earth become a giant snowball 700 million years ago, end quote. And of course, you know the answer already, and it's not continental drift, cosmic rays, or anything else, but yep. Quote, the scientists say their research shows how sensitive global climate change is to atmospheric carbon concentration, end quote. Or how sensitive grants and publication are to it. In the newsletter, we also note, again, Greta Thunberg plunging into a disruptive protest, this time it's in France, and again, quote, wearing a Palestinian keffiyeh, end quote. Hooked on fame, she won't stop escalating, including accusing Israel of genocide, until someone gets hurt or someone enforces the law. As Kathleen Stock warned seriously and unheard in January, quote, "We need to free Greta Thunberg," end quote, the former Wunderkind now chasing the dragon. Ah, and more on the snow event, quote, "The Nova Scotia government is asking Ottawa for help as the province digs out from an extreme snowfall that has prompted parts of Cape Breton to declare local states of emergency," end quote, due to cold, not heat. Strange weather we're having, whereas the comparative lack of snow in Ottawa is, obviously, climate-related. Further, we note that Canadian New Democratic Party MP Charlie Angus has introduced C-372, the Fossil Fuel Advertising Act, that would make it illegal to make true statements about fossil fuels if they were positive. Angus denies it, saying his intention is just to make it illegal for the companies to advocate for their perfectly legal product in perfectly factual ways, which is a distinction without a difference and would be a disgrace anyway. It's just a private member's bill, and it almost certainly won't pass. But it is one more reflection of the intolerance of the ostensibly tolerant. Oh, and apparently, quote, "Massive wildfires exposing millions to toxic smoke, drought, shriveling crops and key waterways, destructive storms supercharged by record ocean temperatures. In the last year, the world has had a taste of what to expect with warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius," end quote. So shrieks AFP, whose journalists do not seem to be tasked with checking whether there were an unusual number of wildfires, crop failures, major storms, or anything else in 2023. Which the story then admits, quote, "does not signal a breach of the more ambitious limit agreed by the countries in the 2015 Paris Agreement, because that is measured as an average over two decades," end quote. So, the disasters we were told would happen if we did breach Paris are happening now, even though we didn't, and they didn't. That's how settled science works. In the newsletter, we also note that a crucial part of the solution to the supposed climate crisis is supposedly electric vehicles. And, to save us from ourselves, governments in the industrial world are, or until very recently were, determined to make it illegal for us to buy the reliable ICE, that's internal combustion engine, kind of vehicle instead, if we could still afford gas. But, as Matthew Lynn argued in The Telegraph, quote, "the West's humiliating electric car climb-down has begun. Ambitious plans for an electrification-led industrial revolution are in full-scale retreat," end quote. Sales are collapsing. Companies are canceling or scaling back plans. And Lynn gets to the heart of the matter with his observation that, quote, "amid an onslaught of Chinese competition and falling sales, the West's electric vehicle dream is quickly unraveling, and we need to relearn all the lessons in why grand, state-led industrial strategies never work," end quote. Indeed, we need to relearn them so we can promptly forget them all again in the next panic. This week we also wrapped up our series on ECS in the real world, that is to say, ECS estimates that come from observing real climate data rather than running models, by looking at a September 2023 paper by University of Alabama climatologists Roy Spencer and John Christie. Those are the same experts who invented the modern method of using satellites to monitor atmospheric temperatures, so yes, they are climate scientists. In this study, they used surface thermometer data, despite the known problems with those data sets. And the novelty here is that while climate models do take account of the way in which heat diffuses deep into the ocean, they only include land heat storage down to about 10 meters, whereas studies from boreholes show that heat diffuses hundreds of meters down. So, Spencer and Christie incorporated estimates of heat diffusion going down to 200 meters. Noting that the IPCC now says ECS is at least 2.5, Spencer and Christie conclude in this paper that it's more likely 1.9. Yet again, less than 2, as so often in this reality-based series. In the newsletter, we also look at a recent study by Mika Rantanen and Ari Laksonen about the big jump in temperatures in 2023. Alarmists seized on these as proof of their theory, but the jump, it's about half a degree Celsius, is well above the trend line supposedly driven by CO2 increases. The models didn't predict it, and it turns out that they can't explain it either, not by the observed increase in CO2 or by the natural variability that they have been programmed to believe is present. So, whatever caused it is unknown, even though, yet again, the science is settled. Rantanen and Laksonen say that the cause might have been the Hunga Tonga volcano, but they're not sure, and they don't claim to be. And nor should modelers who can't model the real world. And finally, from the co2science.org archive, we bring you a paper looking at climatically significant volcanic eruptions over the last 600 years to see how likely another one is. And the answer is, yeah, could well happen. The real world is messy. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson. And I think $1 million in punitive damages for no real harm is an embarrassment to justice and to science.
That's right.